seated, please.
The court is now ready to hear argument in 080169 Tangi Walters versus Cleveland Regional Medical Center, Shirley Kiefer and Keith Spooner, M.D.
May it please the court, Mr. Bradshaw Hull will present argument for the petition.
For it. I am proud to represent Tangi Walters, but before I get to Tangi, I want to discuss a fact situation that occurred 50 years ago. Respondents performed a cesarean section on petitioner, and after a long period of increasing internal pain, petitioner submitted to a surgery for what was believed to be a tumor. It was discovered that she did not have a tumor, but a surgical sponge had been left inside her body, allegedly after the surgery. Respondent pled that she had no knowledge and no way of knowing that a surgical sponge had been left inside her body until it was discovered more than 4.5 years later. Despite the fact that Ms. Gaddis had gone ahead and had, according to the Supreme Court, a long period of increasing internal pain in 1965, Gaddis v. Smith was decided. A sponge case, which created the original discovery rule.
Okay, now the statute is quite clear. It says you have 10 years, and if you're
yes, Your Honor.
After back 10 years, you lose. So let's talk about whether or not there's a common law claim here.
Okay, we're within the 10-year statute of repose in our case.
Okay.
In this situation, as in Gaddis, the patient had a sponge in her that may have been causing internal problems for a period of time that she ultimately had a surgery for. In this case, she believed she had a tumor in Gaddis. In our case, Ms. Walters went in for a total hysterectomy, and it was at that time of the total hysterectomy that they determined that she had a sponge in her. Prior to that time, she had seen Dr. Spooner after the surgery. She had seen the staff of Cleveland Regional Medical Center. She'd seen Dr. Beebe. She'd seen Dr. Willems. She'd seen Dr. Garnapudi. She'd seen Dr. Pipkin. None of those doctors were able to go ahead and diagnose that she had a foreign object within her.
Which of those did she see in those first 2 years?
In the first 2 years, she went ahead and saw Dr. Spooner when she was discharged from the hospital, and he told her that the pain that she had in her abdomen was as a result of her breastfeeding, and that once she stopped breastfeeding, the pain in her abdomen subsided.
Okay, let me stop you 1 second. So surgery in December of 95.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the pain present immediately, according to the record?
According to her, immediately afterwards, she was doubled over in pain with more intense pain she'd ever felt in her whole life. And it was at that point in time that she complained to the staff of the hospital, and they gave her 2 enemas, and medication.
Just while she's still in the hospital.
While she was still in the hospital. And she said that after that, the pain became manageable. Then it was after that that she talked to Dr. Spooner. She talked to Dr. Spooner and
how fast was that after the surgery?
That was within the week. And then she had a well visit 2 weeks afterwards with Dr. Spooner, when there's no notation whatsoever that she was having pain at that time. So it's our position that the severe pain that she had was taken care of by the 2 water enemas that they gave her and the medication. There's no evidence in the record that indicates that that severe pain that she was experiencing after the surgery was as a result of the sponge as opposed to as a result of actually having the surgery.
Is there evidence in the record showing sort of continued pain post-surgery during that 2-year period?
No, there is no evidence in the record that she had that. She testified she continued to have some problems. She went to work. She never missed a day from work. She didn't go see any doctors. About in 1998, there were some indications that she began having abdominal pain, which was diagnosed by, I believe, Dr. Beebe as being cystitis. And over that period of time, from 1998 till 2005,
and that was after, of course, the 2-year period.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at 2005's records, in particular Dr. Garnapudi, Dr. Garnapudi says that for about 8 years she was having pain in her abdomen, which would be that 1998 date. So,
is it clear to you that the legislature intended to abolish completely the discovery rule and wanted there to be no more claims after 2 years? So is this only a matter of a constitutional challenge under the open court?
Right. And when that occurred, the Supreme Court went ahead and heard Neagle versus Nelson, which was also a sponge case. There were two sponge cases. The last two sponge cases that I'm aware of that were decided by the Supreme Court were both decided in January of 1985. And in both of those cases, Bradford being the first, it was a per curiam opinion with no discussion, which we believe was basically addressed by the fact that in the Gaddis opinion, the court wrote, is a virtual certainty that the patient has no knowledge on the day following the surgery, nor for a long time thereafter, the foreign body was left in the incision.
It seems pretty clear to me that Ms. Walters could not have done more than she did to find out what was wrong with her. At least a strong case can be made for that. Yet it seems equally clear that this sponge was discoverable just by an x-ray, I take it.
That's what they argue. Dr. Spooner
nor... So what I'm wondering is, do you think open courts just constitutionalizes a discovery rule, or is the rule different?
The rule that was enunciated in Neagle when the first open courts case that dealt with the two-year statute of limitations, which at that point was 4590I, stated that the open courts provision of our Constitution protects a citizen such as Neagle from legislative acts that abridge his right to sue before he had a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit.
It's the such as that makes me wonder, because, you know, we treat the discovery rule categorically,
yes.
And we don't look, there's a determination whether it applies, and that's made irrespective of the particular plaintiff or defendant. It's just, we look at this kind of circumstances and we say, categorically, is this the sort of thing that's inherently undiscoverable or not? Then if it does apply, then we look at the particular plaintiff and we say, well, you did do enough, you didn't do enough, and make an ad hoc, individualized determination. I'm wondering, is that such as, does that mean the same thing happens in the open courts, that there's some sort of broader categorical determination, and then we look at some particularized application?
I think as to such as, they were talking about, again, a person with a foreign body, as opposed to just anybody that's complaining about a misdiagnosis. The two seminal cases dealing with open courts and two, the original discovery, were both sponge cases. And the Supreme Court in Robinson versus Weaver stated the courts long recognized the distinction between cases involving misdiagnosis in foreign objects, and has viewed foreign object cases with greater favor. And Robinson was decided in 1977. Since 1985, there's not been a sponge case before the Supreme Court. And it's our basic position that the reason for that is that the sponge cases are treated differently than the misdiagnosis cases. The actual discovery rule came about as a result of foreign body cases, the sponge case. The problem begins when the Gaddis opinion, which said in it that it should be noted that our holding is limited to causes of action which a physician leaves a foreign object in the patient's body. What happened then was that the Supreme Court went ahead and extended the case or the rationale to those cases that involved misdiagnosis, which creates a whole can of worms.
It seems to me that your argument fundamentally is that the constitutional rule should be the same as Gaddis.
Should be the same as Gaddis and or Nelson v. Cruzan. I mean, there's only a slight difference between the two.
But the open courts and discovery rule for limitations are two quite different things.
Yes. The only reason I say that, Your Honor, is that for the holding in Nelson was to sue before he has a reasonable opportunity to discover the wrong and bring suit. So in Neagle versus Nelson, it's to discover the wrong and bring suit. So she may have had an opportunity to, her doctors may have had the opportunity had they gone ahead and done it, which would include Dr. Spooner. Dr. Spooner's arguing now a simple x-ray would have found the sponge. The problem is he didn't do a simple x-ray. The problem is that Cleveland Regional Hospital didn't do a simple x-ray. In fact, the doctors that eventually saw her prior to the bowel surgeon finding the sponge within the mass, they did pelvic CAT scans. I mean, they did more advanced tests trying to find out what was wrong with her. Unfortunately, the CT scan wouldn't have shown the sponge and didn't show the sponge.
I'm looking at it a little more broadly, and I'm wondering, you know, the classic argument under open courts is workers' compensation. And maybe it's because it was one of the earlier ones. And the argument is, well, you can change the whole employer-employee injury compensation system, even though there are some plaintiffs who can easily prove fault, and there are some employers who can easily prove no fault, but we're going to lump them all together and we're going to say this is a good, fair system for everybody. Can the legislature for medical malpractice come in and say, well, there are some sponge cases where you're going to be able to prove it, some where you're not going to be able to, some things that can be brought in 2 years, some things that are going to take longer. We're going to try to make a comprehensive solution.
Well, I think the legislature perhaps could have done that. We're still waiting for the legislature in medical malpractice to give us that form set of interrogatories they said they were going to give us. So if they can't go ahead and give us the standard form interrogatories in a Med-Mal case, I don't think they can go through line item and say these cases are covered, these cases aren't covered.
But and you think open courts would allow them to do that?
I think open courts, no, I think you would then have to go and revisit to see whether or not it was a violation of the open courts. I think you're the actual final arbiter of whether or not it's an open courts violation.
Right, but at least it's consistent with the jurisprudence to say they could take caps, limitations, all, you know, burdens of proof, all kind of, whether there's an expert report, all these things into account and say, we're going to restructure this whole system, and that meets open courts, even though there may be a case here and a case there that those people complain under the old system, I would have done better.
I think that those folks can still come in and address before you whether or not it's an open courts violation. Then I think that it is a very, very small segment of individuals that can come forward and talk about open courts. I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. For instance, in Res Ipsa, the Supreme Court actually, I mean, the legislature actually went forward and say, you don't need an expert. Now, the Supreme Court says you do on causation, but in terms of on negligence, you don't need to have an expert in certain cases, one of them being operating on the wrong part of the body, leaving a foreign body. I understand, I think that's what you're talking about. You could make a laundry list of cases that they say do or don't violate the open courts provision.
Well, and besides, it would be hard for a workers' comp employee or employer, but just take the employee, to come in and say, well, fine, that was a fine system for everybody else, but I can prove negligence top side and bottom, and I shouldn't have to suffer because you made a system for everybody else.
Right, and I understand, and I agree in that circumstance. If all you're saying is that in this case, I could have proven it. I mean, someone bought insurance and they bought it for this premium, for this coverage. They've been selling medical malpractice insurance since 1985, the last time you revisited foreign object cases. And so I think that both the insurers and the doctors are aware that if you leave a foreign body.
And you would have us continue that trend. So Gaddis and Nelson and now this case, every foreign object case that is not discoverable would violate open courts to apply the two-year statute of limitations.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would the same analysis apply, or would it be different for statutes of repose? Would the same analysis mean 10 years is that limit is unconstitutional, and if not, why not? What's the difference?
Statute of repose is something that occurred more recently by the legislature with a whole different legislative history. The article that we're talking about originally in the 2 year statute of limitations for a medical malpractice case, I believe it's article 5.62 or whatever it was many, many moons ago when we all first practiced law.
My point is, no, this is not your case, but can the legislature say, well, there is going to be an outside limit and we're going to enforce it, and is that in general constitutional? What's the difference between 2 years and 10 years?
I think, again, if in the 10 years they were looking at the Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act, I mean, you'd have to consider what was the legislative history. Here, we're looking at ancient legislative history in our case, because in every reformulation of this rule since 1975, I believe, 68. We've been dealing with the same language, be it the original article in the insurance code, then we're dealing with 4590I, then we're dealing with Chapter 74. It's identical language, and so I haven't gone ahead and gotten into ancient legislative history. Obviously, what was going on in the insurance code back in the 60s is not relevant to what was presently going on with the quote-unquote need for tort reform, which is a whole other can of worms for us. But in this situation, if you're saying, do we have a separate rule for the sponge people versus everybody else? Well, in looking at it and what the Supreme Court has written on in the past is basically that the sponge cases are not particularly susceptible to fraudulent prosecution. There's either a sponge or there's not. No one's going to open themselves up and shove one in. Furthermore, the injuries are objectively verifiable since the sponge is discovered in a mass at the time it finally is discovered, either as in Gaddis when it was in a tumor, or with Tangi Walters when it was in adhesions that were bound to her bowel and to her uterus. Furthermore, one of the reasons to have the statute of limitations back when they did the insurance code was to go ahead and avoid stale claims that the doctor would have to defend. But in our instance, all of the witnesses, Tangi Walters, Dr. Spooner, Shirley Kiefer, the scrub nurse, have all been deposed. All of the medical records, be they either from Dr. Spooner, Cleveland Regional, Dr. Beebe, Dr. Willens, Dr. Pipkin, Dr. Garnapudi, are all in evidence.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired.
I apologize.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
Ms. Faust and Mr. Sheehy will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Sheehy will open with the first 10 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Richard Sheehy. I'm here on behalf of the hospital and the nurse. As always, I am pleased to be before the court. There is no dispute in this case that the plaintiff's claim is barred by the applicable statute of limitations. The alleged malpractice took place in December of 1995. The case was filed in August of 2005. I take issue with the comment about the record made by my friend, Mr. Bradshaw Hull, that there is no evidence of pain between 1995 and 1998. We believe the record is clear that she was complaining about abdominal pain in the same part of her body starting shortly after the surgery and continuing on for a period of 10 years. That is in the record. We believe it is clear that is there, and that it was not that she was pain-free during the time that the statute of limitations.
So you said the record shows continuous pain from the date of surgery for those first couple of years afterwards?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is it your position she would not have had pain from anything else? It had to be from the sponge?
Well, certainly it would have been. The only condition that she mentioned that she had suffered from pain before the surgery was pain from an abnormal menstrual cycle. She had that same pain before the surgery. She did not say that she was suffering from pain from any other condition. And in fact, during the first 2 years that after the surgery, she didn't see a doctor at all. So to blame some other condition as the basis for her pain makes no sense at all when she sought no medical treatment at all during that period of time.
If she had never complained of pain, would you say her claim was still barred?
Yes, Your Honor, I would, and that really comes down to what Justice Heck was talking about, and that has to do with the whole issue about what can the legislature do under the open courts provision. If I can, I'll come back to that. Can I come back to that in just a second? No, I won't. You're the judge. I will follow what you ask. Although I have to say that when I hear about 1975 being ancient history, it makes me a little nervous. I remember 1975. Certainly, it's a more difficult case. That had there been no pain, no indication at all, suffering from a problem, the question then really becomes.
But I'm not sure I understand that, because but for the statute, the discovery rule would apply. Pain, x-ray, no x-ray, it would apply, right?
Correct. There is no discovery rule from the ancient history.
An SV. If it weren't for the statute, the discovery rule would apply, and then the pain only goes to whether the person using protected by the discovery rule, used appropriate diligence in discovering torture.
No, certainly. No question that if we were back prior to the ancient history of 1975, the discovery rule would apply. But we know that starting in 1975, the legislature said we are not going to have a discovery rule. There's an absolute two-year statute of limitations.
But I was asking because you said that the pain matters, and if it doesn't matter to the application of the existence of the discovery rule, it only matters in its individual application. Is it different for open courts?
Okay. Let me address that directly because I think that raises a significant question about which direction this court is going to go with respect to the open courts provision. As your honors are aware, there are two parts of the open courts doctrine. The first is, of course, the well-recognized cause of action that is common law cause of action that is being restricted. And number two, that the restriction by the legislature is arbitrary or unreasonable when judged against the rights that it is restricting. Up until now, within reason, I think it is fair to say that the court has held in other cases that when it is impossible, and we can talk about the standard in just a second, but when it is impossible or exceedingly difficult for a plaintiff to discover, then in fact the balance tips away from the legislature in favor of the plaintiff. I certainly believe this court may decide that in this context of this medical malpractice statute, that the legislature may impose a strict two-year statute of limitations, and we're sorry that it may cause problems for a limited number of people, but we believe that the legislative intent or the public policy outweighs, in favor of the two-year statute, outweighs any problems it may cause.
We have to overrule Gaddis and Nelson to say exactly that?
Well, I think Gaddis, clearly, because I think the statute has essentially done that. I would like to say that you wouldn't have to overrule the opinions of this court since that time. I will tell you, you're going to have to distinguish them probably to the extent that you would effectively be overruling them, because I think there is at least language. Now, whether it's dicta or not, I'd have to go back and think about that a little bit more. But clearly, up until now, this court has held that the two-year statute of limitations, the absolute two-year statute of limitation, is not immune from an open court's challenge. And again, you may be able to, and if I went back and looked at it and determined if it was dicta, you may not have to overrule them. But getting to your honors, Justice Heck's point, that if in fact this court decides that the absolute two-year statute of limitations is a reasonable and non-arbitrary exercise of police power such that we are going to enforce it, even though there may be circumstances in which an individual plaintiff may suffer, so be it. And under those circumstances, Your Honor, pain has nothing to do with it.
In that situation, what would be the purpose then of the 10-year statute of repose?
Well, there may not be a purpose of the 10-year statute. As I recall the legislative history, Your Honor, I believe that the 10-year statute of repose was put into the statute, into Chapter 74, to deal with, Your Honors, the court's rulings in prior cases on minors. Because it's very unusual for the legislature to specifically say, this is a statute of repose. And I suspect the legislature did that because this court up until now has drawn a distinction between statutes of limitations and statutes of repose in the sense that the court has been very unsympathetic to open court's challenges to statutes of repose. And quite honestly, I'm getting a little bit out of the area because I haven't studied this for purposes
we'll
of this case.
We'll hear about that in just a moment. But,
right.
But if we were to disagree with you and think that to hold your way would overrule Nelson and other cases, Morris versus Chan and other, and decided not to, just in terms of stare decisis, what would the remedy be? It couldn't be a legislative fix, right? So the Constitution would have to be amended?
I would think so.
And do you think the people of Texas would say in a referendum that when a sponge is discovered, you know, 8 years after the surgery that really couldn't have been discovered beforehand, that claim would be or should be barred?
Let me, if I may, disagree a little bit. If Your Honor is talking about our case, we believe, of course, it could have been discovered within months after the surgery. So
if what had happened?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could have been discovered if what had happened?
Two parts of that answer. The first is that she doesn't have to discover the sponge. All she has to discover is the fact of injury. That's what starts the statute of limitations. She does not have to know the cause. But secondly, had she gone to a specialist, to an OBGYN, which she did 10 years later, and within 60 days, we had the sponge discovered. Again, not conceding that the sponge was left in on this particular surgery, but for purposes here, let's assume
that
it was.
Does the record show that she was ever referred to a specialist before she went to the one who discovered the sponge?
I don't think the record reflects either way, Your Honor. We know that she didn't seek any medical treatment at all for 2.5 years after the surgery, or two weeks after the surgery.
Do you think there's a fact question about whether the sponge was left in 1995 or not?
Your Honor, I'm not ready to concede that because there was another surgery in April of 2005 in which an incision was made where the first indication was that there may be a problem. We don't know. I mean, I think for purposes here, in terms of Your Honor's analysis, because the claim of the plaintiff is for negligence during 1995, we probably have to assume for that purpose that the allegation deals with a wrongful act that took place then. But I don't want the court to believe that we are conceding that, in fact, that happened. There are reasons why we think
it did
not.
How are the facts here substantially different from the facts in Nelson, the other sponge case?
Well, if we are not going to go down the path of an absolute two-year statute being applied in each time, then in the other cases, there seems to be no question on the part of the court that the injury was impossible to discover during the two-year statute of limitations. In this case, the facts of this case, that is not so. It's
because
not
she,
so by a long shot.
Because she complained about pain.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Because she complained about pain.
She complained about pain increasing over time in the same part of her body during that point in time. I mean, and in fact, in the cases, some of the cases, Boyd versus Callum, that the plaintiffs rely on, the court, in fact, distinguishes all the other cases on the grounds that there was no indication of any pain or injury during the time that the statute of limitations was running. In our case, under the facts of this case, if Your Honors are going to not go down the path that I would like you to go, which is two-year statute is absolute, then the question becomes, how do we phrase the test on terms of how the open courts provision applies? And then using that test, because the court has to decide this as a matter of law, does the plaintiff meet that test in order to avoid the statute of limitations in the face of a constitutional challenge? And I think Justice Heck was asking this question a little bit earlier, it is important that, number one, we understand that there is a distinction between the discovery rule and invalidating a statute under the open courts provision. There's a great distinction between those two things.
And maybe we can hear more about that from Ms. Faust, who, because your time's expired here.
I think that will let me, I'm sorry, make one final point, knowing that it's coming off of her time. And that is that, keeping in mind also, we have to remember that second prong of the open courts test. And although we may not say we're going to say it's absolutely 2 years and the public policy is such that we're going to apply it across the board, the test that we use to determine if there is an open courts violation has got to be viewed in that context. That is, we have got to give the legislature a tremendous amount of leeway if we're going to use that balancing test between arbitrary and unreasonable.
You said impossible to discover. That's not really a standard, is it?
Impossible.
They're all possible.
Well, there are several ways that the court has done this. Impossible or exceedingly difficult.
But impossible is what I'm focusing on.
Well, that the court has used the term impossible because they talk about an impossibility. We're not going to require people to achieve an impossibility. That's probably a little strong for going down the road, but exceedingly difficult, I think, is certainly an appropriate test. Or, you know, could it have been discovered? And in this case, we know that it could have been. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. Here on behalf of Dr. Spooner and co-defendant's counsel, I think, has cleared up the questions with regard to the status of the record here, and I just would like to again emphasize that the record here is clear. Both of the respondents have pointed out in their briefs the various testimony by Ms. Walters herself, in addition to the medical records that shows that she had admitted to having pain, abdominal pain, in the same location for 7, 8, 9 years. That was the question posed to her. She answered yes, and the pain was always in the same location for 10 years.
What difference does that make? Let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that in this case she had pain, and every time she went to the doctor, and she went to the doctor 20 times over a period of 9 years, and every time they didn't discover, they had no reason to believe it could possibly be a sponge. Would that be a different case? Under your analysis, wouldn't matter whether she went or not, would it?
Your Honor, where it makes a difference, I think, is that we have the court looking at, and again, looking at the test, whether it's unreasonable or arbitrary. This court has said we will not require a claimant to perform an impossible condition. And taking from that, a lot of times, the court's analysis, not necessarily this court, but the various courts of appeals will say, well, this was an impossible condition, and here are some examples of impossible conditions. We do have this court saying in Shaw versus Moss that there is a reasonable opportunity to discover the injury. In that particular case, it was eye surgery to correct a detached retina. And then there is a continuation of the vision problem. There are other cases out of courts of appeals where there is a continuation of pain, or a continuation or worsening of a symptom. And the courts, including this court in Shaw, has concluded that constitutes a reasonable opportunity to discover under the standard for open courts analysis. So I think that's where the facts in this case make it important. If you look at this court's pronouncements, that we're not going to require a claimant to perform an impossible condition,
so
that is filed a suit.
If she had gone once a month for 9 years and nobody had discovered it, then you'd say she did all she could, and she would meet the discovery rule, or she wouldn't be bound by the 2-year statute of limitations.
Well, I think, Your Honor, it certainly might seem to make it appear more different. It'd be a much cleaner if she's asymptomatic, but it then brings into the question of whether or not she's been misdiagnosed, and whether then there is an issue with respect to what those separate diagnoses are each time she goes to see someone for that symptom.
So I can't tell if you're telling me that would be a different test or the same test.
Well, I think, Your Honor, if this court is going to stay with the test that we're not going to require her to perform an impossible condition, that could, under the prior misdiagnosis cases, could constitute an impossible condition. I think that would save her case from
what. What if, as I asked Mr. Sheehy, she had never complained of pain, was not symptomatic at all, would her claim still be barred under the 2-year limitation statute?
Your Honor, under the prior asymptomatic cases, it probably would not be. Would not be barred.
But let me understand, are we applying this on a plaintiff-by-plaintiff basis, this constitutional rule, or are we talking about these kinds of cases? Because in Sachs and in Weiner, for example, in the minor context, we said, well, you can get your minorities removed, your parents can sue, all these other things can happen. We look at that across the board and say, well, those opportunities are not enough to give people in this position fair access to their common law claim. It doesn't matter that in a particular instance the plaintiff's parents were absolutely willing to sue, or that the person had the minorities removed, or any of the, we're just looking at across the board, is that right? And the circumstances here are just illustrative of what might happen, but we're still looking for a constitutional answer.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think, for example, in the Weiner versus Wasson case, when the court, and Sachs refused to go down that path and did apply it broadly, more like a facial challenge, if you will. Here, the only way that this claim has been brought is as applied.
Well, I'm wondering, is there an as applied challenge under open courts? And I'm not sure I see what sense that makes, but we've never been clear on that. But it's hard to understand how there can be an as applied challenge, although open courts is a lot like due process, so maybe there is. But
well, and in looking at Weiner versus Wasson and the dissenting opinion there, which of course is not binding on this court, but
but it was well done.
Well done, yes, Your Honor. The test, it was discussed that the test should be applied each and every time that one of these cases comes to you. The complete test should be applied, and we shouldn't just have a cursory review of, oh, well, these facts constitute an impossible condition because it's a retained object. Technology has changed a lot. In 1995, from 1975, we now have radio opaque sponges that show up on x-rays, and we have radio opaque strips on towels. We had one of those cases recently. We had a pair of scissors in a young lady for 10 years a few years ago. These cases continue to happen, but they're very, very seemingly rare as compared to the other types.
When we're considering whether a plaintiff has had a reasonable opportunity to discover the injury, I mean, what factor stands out to you as sort of the most pivotal or important that we ought to look at?
Looking at whether there's a reasonable opportunity to discover, I think that the court is going to need to, first of all, it will be a question of law. It's a constitutional issue. So obviously there won't be any fact issue with regard to what the claimant did or did not do during the statute of limitations period. If the record can be developed in such a way to show, as in this case, that no treatment was sought despite symptoms that by her own admission existed during that time, then I think that could weigh heavily in the court's analysis that she had a reasonable opportunity. She was on notice that she had a continuing symptom because she had the pain prior to the surgery. And then when it persisted for years, it, under her own testimony, progressed, Your Honor, I think that would be important for the court to look at. Also, I think it would be important to look at whether or not she...
Let me ask you a hypothetical as your time's running out here. What if a little pill encapsulated in plastic were left inside her, and there was some kind of medication in front of the little pill, but it didn't rupture until 3 years after the surgery? I guess you would say the two-year statute of limitations would be a violation of, to apply it, would be a violation of the open court provision.
It could be under that scenario if we look at the open
courts.
Could
or would? What's your opinion?
Well, depending on all the facts, Your Honor, if nothing, no pain, no symptoms, then I think the court would have to look at
when it ruptured,
that analysis.
Did it cause a problem?
I'm sorry?
In my scenario, only when it ruptured did it cause a problem.
I think under the court's prior precedence, yes, it would constitute a violation of open
statute
courts.
Of repose that says, sets a, let's say, a 5-year statute, or let's say 10 years, and this little pill doesn't rupture till 11 years after the surgery, and that's the only time there's any pain or problem after the rupture. Would you say the same thing for a statute of repose then?
Your Honor, the statute of repose is quite different than limitations of repose. And this court said in Holubac is a different analysis, and we'll talk more about that in the next case. But also, what's important has been talked about here previously is the legislative history in 2003 and the factors that this court looked at in URS and other repose cases, for example, the extent of the remedy. How many people would be affected by this if we cut it off at 10 years? And there are various other factors that I think will be discussed later. But it's different, and we would not agree.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Butler. Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that the issue of pain is a red herring. When you're looking at the Neagle v. Nelson case, where it says the open courts provision of our Constitution protects a citizen such as Neagle, immediately before that, the paragraph before, they deal with the Nelson v. Cruzan situation, which is relating to minors. And in fact, that's what they said. We've likewise declared unconstitutional that part of Article 4.82, Section 4, relating to minors. The Neagle decision was months after Cruzan. The other thing is that 2 weeks before the Neagle case came down, the court wrote Bradford. And if I can, I'll read the opinion in Bradford. It was per curiam.
This is a medical malpractice suit. On November 1st, 1980, Mrs. Bradford discovered a sponge apparently left during surgery in 1975. Suit was filed in October the 5th of 1981. The trial court rendered summary judgments for the defendants based on Article 5.82, Section 4 of the Insurance Code. The Court of Appeals affirmed in an unpublished opinion. Pursuant to Rule 483, we grant the application for writ of error and without hearing oral argument, in accordance with this court's decision in Nelson v. Cruzen, we reverse and remand. There is no discussion whatsoever about pain, about when she should or could or would, or if it was impossible or possible. It just says this is a sponge case and we are going to go ahead and reverse it. And since that case came down, other than the case that was decided 2 weeks later, there have been no more sponge cases reach you. And the reason for that is that the sponge cases are handled directly the same way as they are in the minors cases. The other thing about pain being a red herring, on June the 29th of 2006, I took Dr. Spooner's deposition, and I went through all of the complaints that she made. I asked him, there's a document on file at the courthouse, which was his motion for summary judgment, that says, since plaintiff began experiencing pelvic slash abdominal pain immediately following the tubal ligation and continued to experience a chronic pelvic slash abdominal pain over the course of 9 to 10 years prior to removal of the sponge, plaintiff could have reasonably known of her condition was related to tubal ligation in 1995. I said, do you agree or disagree or have no opinion? He says, I disagree with the statement. I ask him, why do you disagree? I said, without evaluating the patient, it would be very difficult to make that decision. The trial court made the decision that because she was complaining of pain, therefore she should have known about the sponge. Dr. Spooner himself wouldn't even make that jump and say that the pain that she had was from the sponge. She could have pain after the surgery, and in fact testified that she had doubling over pain and had been told prior to the surgery that with a tubal ligation you're going to have pain and that her pain became manageable afterwards.
Are the standards, and the Fifth Circuit said this, exceedingly difficult and should have known, essentially the same thing?
What they said in Nelson v. Cruzen is you have to have a reasonable opportunity to discover and file suit, which I believe is what the standard is. The impossibility problem begins when they say you have to do the impossible, which is to file suit before you have a reasonable opportunity to discover that there was a injury, so which is what they discussed in Cruzen. And in Cruzen, the child had Duchenne's, and there was evidence when he had stumbling that they could have run a test and determined from that test at that point, 2 years prior to the time they actually did the test, that the kid had Duchenne's.
What then would you believe, counsel, constitutes a reasonable opportunity to discover in a sponge case?
It has to be actually discovered. I mean, she went through...
So take out reasonable opportunity in the phrase and just say discover.
No, reasonable means you have to have a physician go ahead and do it. I think that's what's reasonable.
Well, I asked what would constitute a reasonable opportunity to discover, and you said it has to be discovered. Sounds like you took reasonable opportunity out of the sentence.
Well, reasonable opportunity in terms of a medical malpractice case, because we're not going to allow Tangie Walters to testify at trial. All of these problems are from my sponge, or I knew my sponge was causing all of these problems. She's never going to get to say any of that. She's not qualified to say any of that. So a reasonable opportunity obviously has to, not obviously, I believe, has to do with a medical doctor has to go ahead and make a determination that there is a sponge.
What if the sponge is not discovered and we bump into the 10-year statute of repose period?
Well, I'm going to stick around and I'm going to listen. And maybe I'm going to get some free CLE out of that, Your Honor.
Well, you're not getting out of it that easy.
I figured not. I know you too well. That again,
we're deciding your case,
sure,
and it's important to try to get that right, of course. But we've got a big picture to look at, and it has to be sensical and logical. What's the big picture? Or
your
position does not take us astray.
Right, a reasonable opportunity, regardless if it's my case or the next case, according to Neagle versus Nelson, is a violation of the open courts to go ahead and say you're going to pour someone out before that sponge is found. That's what the law is from Bradford. That's what the law is from Neagle versus Nelson. What you're getting into, and I know you guys have gone, and woman, I've gone ahead and written on Pachuca and on some different matters lately dealing with repose, and you're up a whole lot more on that than I am, Judge, and maybe they're up more on that. But I would say that, but for repose, there's no difference between if it's 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years in terms of what is required. Because I believe it's an absolute when it says such as Neagle in the paragraph that includes such as Cruzan, which was the minor case. And going back to what the legislature's done in segregating Ray Ipsa minors cases, foreign body cases, I think it's been treated that way for the past 20 years.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The clause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.